This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. We'll meet a master of podcasting later in the show. But first, this month marks the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon Johnson's decision to begin the massive escalation of the Vietnam War. The war, which ended in April 1975, bitterly divided the United States between those who saw a need to suppress the spread of communism and those who challenged the morality, legality, and practicality of fighting in a distant Southeast Asian country. Vietnam's impact is still being felt today, especially in the two recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Christian Oppie, author and professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, takes a look at the Vietnam War and its aftermath in his new book, American Reckoning, The Vietnam War and Our National Identity. He joins us to discuss the war and his book. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Christian, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
And Christian, in addition to American Reckoning, you've written two other books on the Vietnam War. You teach about it at the college level. Now, why is it that this war that ended in 1975 is a topic that you feel so strongly about? What makes it relevant today?
Well, very simply, there's so many important lessons that I think we should have learned from the war and haven't. So I feel very committed to educating younger people about that experience and talking about the parallels between then and now. I would just say that the lesson for me that we should have learned from the Vietnam War is that our foreign policy needs to be more openly debated, and the public needs to be more informed. And our congressional representatives have to do their constitutional duty to make decisions on war and peace, and that hasn't happened, that more and more policymaking has been left in the hands of a tiny elite making decisions in our name. And we have to recover some control over that foreign policy.
Now, you were talking about some of the parallels that you see between then and now. What are some of those parallels?
Well, I think one of the things that came to light in the 1960s, and it was a very painful kind of awakening because the generation that came of age in the 60s and had going back to World War II in the 50s had been real believers, real faithful believers in this idea of American exceptionalism, that we were forever and always a force for good in the world, that we were the good guys, that we would always stand up for democracy and freedom, and that we trusted the government to exercise those, assert those ideals throughout the world, so that in the mid-60s, as more and more Americans began to realize that, in fact, that trusted government had actually distorted and, in some cases, flat-out lied about the origins and conduct of the war, and even about their own private misgivings about the possibility for us to be successful there. As more and more of that got exposed, it really did lead to this really cataclysmic soul-searching and challenging of so many assumptions about American virtue and how we behave in the world. And in my own mind, some of that criticism was really positive, but it just didn't stick as an ongoing lesson. And part of the reason I argue in American Reckoning is that in the 1980s, we began to kind of repackage the Vietnam War as an American tragedy in which we were concerned less with what we did in and to Vietnam and all of that, you know, very troubling history, and tried to replace it with concerns about what the war did to us and how it may have weakened us or hurt our pride and our patriotism and our power. So the emphasis in the Reagan years and even beyond has been to try to patch up our own wounds and heal from the war. And for a time, there was a certain restraint on our getting involved in wars that might lead to a lot of American casualties. It's sort of a notable fact that between the end of the Vietnam War and 9/11, only about 800 Americans died in combat. I mean, we intervened in a number of places, and we're not about to sort of become isolationists. We certainly didn't, you know, give up more than 800 foreign bases and so forth. But it was only after 9/11 that we really kind of, in my mind, completely threw out the window some of the more important lessons of the Vietnam War, some of them articulated by Colin Powell, who had served for basically every president from Reagan forward. And he came up with a set of principles that seemed quite sensible, that never again should we fight a war unless it were really a last resort, unless it had a clear objective and a realizable objective, and one that was widely supported by the American people and even internationally, and that if things should go awry, we would have an exit strategy from. But the people that took us into Iraq and Afghanistan, they had Colin Powell on their Secretary of State, and he had private misgivings, but he kind of got on the team when asked. So even he kind of threw away his own best principles coming out of the, you know, his own experience as a junior officer in Vietnam.
Let's go back in time somewhat. How did this distant, far-off Southeast Asian nation come into the American consciousness? Was that in big part because of the role of Thomas Dooley's book, Deliver Us from Evil?
Yeah, Tom Dooley was a Navy doctor, and he's now pretty much forgotten in American memory. But back in the 50s, if you read some of those magazine polls, who's the most admired man in the world, he often ranked right behind the Pope and President Eisenhower. He was considered a kind of American Albert Schweitzer, who had set up medical clinics in Southeast Asia and kind of represented the best of American idealism, which really was widely felt, I think, at the time, that we could do good in the world. It was kind of like the whole motivation behind the Peace Corps. In fact, when John Kennedy introduced the Peace Corps, he invoked the name of Tom Dooley as a perfect representative of that. And he first described our venture in Vietnam as a kind of almost religious effort to save poor, suffering refugees from godless communism and help them build an independent country in South Vietnam, and wrote, as you say, that best-selling book called Deliver Us from Evil. So that, you know, I think one of the reasons all that gets sort of forgotten is that those kinds of faiths, and much of his account, as it turns out, was really kind of unvarnished propaganda with a lot of unverified stories of communist jamming chopsticks into the ears of little Catholic school children who were, you know, saying mass, which sort of inflamed this America's sense of righteous justice in going in to South Vietnam. By the 60s, a lot of that came into question, and including, just to pick one example, Americans began to realize that there had been an election called for by the Geneva Accords that had ended the French colonial war in Indochina. It called for a reunification election in Vietnam in 1956, and the United States blocked that election and sort of stood in the way of democracy because Eisenhower and his advisors were convinced that Ho Chi Minh, the communist leader in Vietnam, would have almost certainly won an overwhelming victory. Vietnam was never intended to be a permanently divided country, but those elections were never held. So as Americans became aware of things like that and also the sort of brutal and often indiscriminate way in which the war was waged based on the creation of free fire zones and heavy, heavy bombing, particularly in the South, and the revelation of the My Lai massacre that took place in 1968, in which a company went into a village and murdered about 500 unarmed and unresisting civilians, most of them women, children, and old men. That was devastating and shocking, and I think students today, you know, they tell me that this usually doesn't get discussed in high school. It's kind of unknown history to them. So that's part of what I'm trying to recover in this book.
Wasn't it, you were talking about President Eisenhower earlier, wasn't it President Eisenhower who laid out the domino theory, the idea that if one country falls to communism, then other countries are going to fall to communism after that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they believed it. I don't think they were being insincere about that. I think Kennedy also believed it. But what fascinates me is that by the mid-60s, and when Johnson was making those key decisions to really move us from fewer than 20,000 troops up to more than 500,000, he privately and most of his advisors really had no confidence that they could successfully preserve this this South Vietnamese government. And more than that, they no longer believed in the danger of the domino theory. They didn't really think that a communist takeover in Vietnam had anything to do with our national security. And they said among themselves, the only reason we really need to stick it out is if we withdraw, we will be seen as, we will be humiliating to our power and prestige, our reputation, our image. We'll be seen as paper tigers. And to me, that's appalling, because if that's you're sending many, many people, you know, to their deaths for an image and a reputation, not for some cause that you believe is absolutely just and that imperils our entire security as a nation. So that it really did become about credibility. And then ironically, of course, the more we fought, the longer we fought, our reputation was hurt regardless. It actually, our credibility did go down, even among our allies in Europe and Japan and elsewhere. So one of the things I often have thought is that Johnson, who was so shrewd politically, made, I think, a great political miscalculation. Had he the moral courage to have gotten out before most of the people died, when fewer than 400 Americans had been killed, I think he politically would have recovered. I think he, but as it turned out, by 1968, the war was so unpopular, he bowed out of the 1968 presidential election before it was even really engaged.
So you'd say that decision to escalate the Vietnam War cost him the presidency.
Yeah, I would say that's pretty clear. You know, Robert Kennedy, who jumped in along with Eugene McCarthy as anti-war candidates, were gaining increasing traction. And there's a very good chance, had Robert Kennedy not been assassinated in June of that year, that he might have gone on to become the Democratic nominee for president.
More on the Vietnam War and how its impact is being felt even today. We'll continue our conversation with Christian Oppie after the break, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us this afternoon is Christian Oppie, author and professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. His new book is American Reckoning, the Vietnam War and Our National Identity. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Christian, it sounds like you might be a proponent of what George Santayana said, that those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Is that the case behind writing this book?
Very much, though. I don't think history repeats itself in any kind of neat way, but I do think it certainly shapes the present, whether we're conscious of those roots or not. And so the more conscious we are of the way history shapes the present, I think the more intelligently we can sort of debate and discuss where we are and where we want to go.
Now, what do you think about the way that Vietnam veterans have been treated since the war?
Well, you know, in the 1980s, I think as a country, we really came to the conclusion that they had been treated horribly, and there's a lot of truth to that. And I particularly hold the government accountable for that mistreatment, first for sending them to a war under false pretext and putting them in this impossible situation where they were perceived throughout, you know, in the countryside as unwelcome foreigners, and then bringing them home without offering them sufficient benefits and medical support. And I also think, I mean, no one's blameless. I think the corporate America did not do nearly enough to hire and train veterans, and often was scared away by these crude 1970s stereotypes of Vietnam veterans as wacko and drug-addled and violence-prone and, even the traditional veterans organizations, the American Legion and Veterans of Foreign Wars, didn't offer a really welcome, warm hand. But we've sort of blamed, you know, the Americans we've saddled with the most blame really has been the anti-war movement. And while there are undoubtedly some friction there, I think one thing we need to remember is that many veterans themselves came home disillusioned with the war, and a significant number of them participated in the anti-war movement themselves, and that toward the end of the war in Vietnam, many soldiers had were so disaffected with the war, they were deserting in record numbers, they were turning on their officers, they, in some cases, were avoiding or even refusing combat. So some commanders were actually more concerned that they were losing their own troops than fighting the enemy. So it was, you know, it divided the whole country. It wasn't a simple, you know, there were the pro-war vets and there were the anti-war students. It was a much more of a mixed bag. But in our effort to sort of make it up to the Vietnam veterans, I think we've relied a lot too much on sort of empty gestures. We now routinely tell troops, thank you for your service, and that's fine, but it doesn't really ask anything of us. I think we should be asking them other things like, please tell us about your service, because we have something to learn about that, and that will help open up just the kind of discussion and debate we need as a democracy to really make better decisions in terms of foreign policy and to try to bridge the gap between the military and the civilian society. I mean, we rely on this tiny fraction of Americans, less than 1%, to fight in our name, and we often don't know who they are or what they're doing. And we've been living in wartime for almost 15 years, but we don't have any consciousness or any. There's no sacrifice for among the rest of us. We don't even have to pay any higher taxes to afford it. So I think there are all kinds of ways to support the troops. And unfortunately, I think we have relied much too much on a kind of superficial, kind of meaningless support, not enough substantial. Support and not enough debate about when and why we put them into harm's way.
Let's talk with Nelson in East Walnut Hills. Good afternoon, Nelson. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Good afternoon, and thank you both for bringing this important topic to the fore, and thank you for your work on American Reckoning, Chris. You've touched on so many important points. I'm a Vietnam-era combat intelligence officer, having served in both conventional and special ops units. And I just buried my dad of 91 and a half years old, who fought in two wars. And his statement was exactly what you just finished concluding, that the American public just doesn't seem to be engaged in these conflicts to the extent that they need to be, and that war is hell. And that one of the things that I'm trying to do as a veteran is advocate in Washington with our elected officials as a veteran for smart power. In other words, balancing our strong defense with a strong diplomatic and economic development foreign assistance proposition, if you will, and getting the American public to understand that there is that balance. And I'd welcome your thoughts in terms of getting that message out there, not only to the young people, but to our elected officials and those in the general public. And thank you.
Thank you, Nelson, for the call.
Yeah,
we appreciate it.
Yeah, I would just, amen. I would just echo what you said. I think that's very important. That's definitely a step in the right direction.
Let's talk with Marshall in Cincinnati. Good afternoon, Marshall. Afternoon, Marshall. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Good afternoon. I was drafted in the Marine Corps during Vietnam, and I pretty much became disengaged from any kind of larger civic duty after that. And although I did serve at a couple local positions where I live, elected, I ran unopposed. That's how I got elected. Anyway, the thing that I noticed about reporting from what we think are vital issues are what you hear is what's sponsored by somebody who's selling something. I think it was Bill Maher got kicked off of the thing when he said something about 9/11 that didn't sync with what the media was selling. And I think we have a commercial media And so I don't know how you expect people to get who are working and who are in life to be involved in something that's never reported. You know, it's the heroes are here. Either the heroes are living or the heroes are dead. But it doesn't seem to me that we have a hero in a position of policy.
Now, you're saying that the media's got a short-term memory, right, Marshall? That's what you're getting at, right?
Short-term memory, but they don't even address anything. It's not a sponsored event. I mean,
Christian, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I do think that media representations of foreign policy are a problem, and, you know, it's a good thing in some ways that we have such a variety of different forms that the media take, you know, on the internet and, you know, sort of smaller radio stations and other forums. But I really think it puts the pressure on citizens to come up with alternative ways of discussing and debating these things.
Marshall, thanks for the phone call. And Christian, do you think that America still has opportunities to be a force for good in the world?
Yeah, I sure hope so. I'm basically by nature an optimist, but I think as a historian, you have to take the long view. And, you know, I could be very pessimistic over the next few years, but 30, 40, 50 years down the road, I certainly hope so. But I do think we would be helped by not thinking of ourselves as the indispensable sort of policeman of the world, and really work harder at what our first caller was talking about in terms of reaching out in a diplomatic way to other countries and recognizing that we're all in this together. And if we're really going to have enduring global peace, you know, you can't rely on one superpower. It just hasn't been shown throughout history that works.
So you take that same thought and apply it to how we fight against terrorism worldwide nowadays?
Yeah, I don't think it, you know, we try to take it on all by ourselves, it can backfire and end up creating more harm than good. I really think there have to be multinational and regional responses to these issues, and not sort of us against the world.
Are you hopeful that the nation's policymakers will start to soak in the lessons from Vietnam if enough people like you keep saying, "Hey, listen, we're missing the point"?
Yeah, I am a little hopeful, but I do think they have to be continually prodded on these things. So, you know, Obama, for example, the other night took a lot of heat for saying that, you know, Christianity has been used to and has been used to justify slavery and Jim Crow and lots of horrible things. But that's the kind of insight that I think actually helps other countries, you know, reach out to us and understand that, you know, we don't present ourselves as, you know, the exemplars of all that is good and righteous in the world. So I think a little modesty. I mean, listen, in churches across America, every Sunday, everyone is told and recognizes that everybody has the capacity to sin and to do evil. But on a national basis, somehow we're not quite so able to incorporate that really important religious insight.
Christian, thank you for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been a great pleasure. I appreciate it.
Christian Oppie, author and professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. His new book is American Reckoning, the Vietnam War and Our National Identity. After the break, we'll find out how Cliff Ravenscraft has turned himself into the podcast Answer Man. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.